Hi, everyone. My name is Brad. I'm the lead pastor at The River. I'm so glad that you've taken time to tune in to this worship experience. I'd invite you to take a deep breath and to come to conscious awareness that God is with you and consciously open your heart to the gift that God has for you, the whisper of His voice, the tenderness of His touch. As you take that breath, as you come into awareness of the goodness of God, I want to ask you, if you can think of a time when your faith in God took a hit, when it was either deflated or crushed. You know, in the Easter narrative, Jesus comes, risen in power, to heal faith that's been beaten down. In a sin-soaked world, faith can be tender, it can be vulnerable. Perhaps you know the story of Elie Wiesel. He was taken to Auschwitz in Germany at age 15 during the Holocaust. Can you imagine, age 15, what were you doing at age 15? As a young person, an adolescent, he saw unspeakable horrors and it damaged his soul. He said, "Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and murdered my soul and turned my dreams into dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God Himself. Never." Let your heart feel the impact of those words. Few of us have experienced such extreme trauma, but we all get beaten down by the circumstances of life. We all come to places where our dreams are dashed and turned to dust. Many of us know someone who has left the faith, and maybe your faith feels on the edge as well. This message is devoted to the renewal of everyone's faith, especially for those whose faith has been dashed upon the rocks. The series is called entitled Beyond, as in Beyond the Grave. It's telling us that even though we have celebrated Easter, it's possible to live within the confines of the grave, as it were. It's possible to live with our heads in Easter Sunday, believing ideas about the resurrection, but to have our hearts stuck in Good Friday, in darkness and in death. And we can acknowledge that reality, that that's us sometimes, because that's where all of Jesus' first disciples are, all of his closest friends. So let's join in to John chapter 20. I believe we're starting in verse 19. It says that Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." And he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nail, and my hand in his side, I will not believe." But a week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." This narrative focuses on the disciple that we for generations have called Doubting Thomas. So I think it's important to note that Jesus never calls him that. Jesus does not judge people in the way that we do. But what does God have to say to us in this narrative? Let me make a couple of comments that I think are interesting and talk about what it would mean for us to follow God into newness of faith and to have our lives enhanced, enriched, and transformed. Well, God has a number of things to say to us. He tells us about the nature of faith. In verse 25, we hear Thomas saying, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hand to put my finger in the mark of those nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." I don't know about you, but I've read this text in the past and thinking like this is a statement of Thomas's hardness of heart, his resistance to believe. And it may be that in some ways, but I also think it has the ring of truth. It's telling us that it's not enough to hear from another. His friends have told him, all of them are saying, "We saw him, he's alive." It's good for us to hear testimonies of other people's experience from God. It's probably necessary in the big picture. But it's no substitute for our own encounter. Faith ultimately is a deep, personal encounter. And I want to speak to those of you who might be, so to speak, riding on the coattails of other people's faith. It's possible to come to church, possible to show up in friendship groups, church small groups, to be riding on the coattails of other people's faith and not to have our own encounter. And I want to say to you, if that sounds anything like you, that God has more in store for you. So stir up hope. Stir up anticipation for more that God has to give you. Secondly, I think God is telling us about the character of Christ, something that we desperately need to be reminded of. In verse 26, it says, although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Remember, they had all failed him. They had all abandoned him, some of them spectacularly so. And yet the risen Christ comes in the midst of fear and failure, not to speak a word of condemnation, but to speak a word of grace and peace. Grace and peace to you, friends. May all your fears be diminished, and may your joy be restored. That's what Jesus is doing. And in this, he is revealing the heart of God in the midst of all of our failures. Friends, many of our failures are spectacular. And some of us have sinned greatly in this past month or in this past year. And there can be a dark cloud that resides over us. We just feel like, what if other people knew? And this text is telling us that Christ comes to us in the midst of our shame to give us peace that washes away all of our sheer shame and fear. The one who came to Thomas also comes to you, invisibly so. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 10, it says that Jesus ascended to the heavens to fill the whole universe with his presence. It's an assurance that in a mystical kind of way, whatever's going on for you, Christ is with you. Whatever struggle you are in, Christ is with you. Whatever challenge you are embarking upon, Christ is with you. If you're depressed, Christ is with you. And the question of the spiritual journey is, can you perceive his invisible presence? Well, I'll say more about that a little bit later. Finally, Christ gives this mysterious exhortation. In verse 27, he says, do not doubt, but believe. I find this to be, in some ways, a frustrating exhortation. If I could simply choose not to doubt, I think I would choose not to doubt. And if I could just choose to believe, I think I would probably choose to believe, but it doesn't feel like it's completely in my control. This is an important topic for us because ever since the Enlightenment in the late 17th century, we are an increasingly skeptical people. Doubt is our default mode regarding anything that we can't prove by experiment. And one can never prove the presence of God by experiment. No one can prove the efficacy of prayer by repeatable experiments. And it's no wonder then that over the last 25 years in the United States, 40 million Americans have deconstructed their way out of church and many of them out of faith. Maybe you're on that edge as well. Doubt is the air we breathe. So what is it that Jesus is saying to a culture of doubt? Well, I'm impressed that Jesus doesn't shame Thomas for his doubt. And I say that because some of us have been in church cultures, Christian community cultures, in which it's not okay to doubt. We have to keep our doubts to ourselves. I think it's important to say that doubt can play a positive role in the growth of faith. A man named Frederick Buechner just passed away a number of years ago, said that doubt is the ants in the pants of faith. It can keep us moving. It can keep us thinking. It can keep us wrestling. And that can be a good thing. There's no shame in doubt. And again, it's probably unavoidable. It's simply the air we breathe. So we don't have to be ashamed of it. But Jesus is also telling Thomas not to doubt. Later in the New Testament, in the book of James in chapter 1, it says that the person who doubts is fundamentally unstable. like the boat at sea driven by the winds and the waves. And James tells us that doubt can keep us from receiving the gifts of God, the wisdom of God, or the grace of God. There's a lot to say about the topic of doubt, but let me summarize it this way. I think that Jesus is not telling us to eliminate intellectual uncertainty. If we are uncertain about something, we are uncertain about something. We cannot simply wash it away. It would be like trying to push the beach ball under the ocean. It will inevitably pop up again. We cannot erase our uncertainty, but we can lean into trust. It would be like the kid in her parents' arms learning to float on her back in the water. There's probably not certainty, but there can be trust in the midst of uncertainty. So I think we could paraphrase Jesus' command to say something like, even in the midst of uncertainty, which is inevitable, nurture a heart of trust in the God who loves you. I'll say it again because this is so important. Even in the midst of inevitable uncertainty, we must do everything we can to nurture a heart of trust in the God who is present and in the God who loves you with everlasting love. How can we nurture a heart of increasing trust in the presence of the invisible Christ? I always feel like, well, it would be nice to have been Thomas, to have gotten the physical experience of putting my hand in his side, even though the text never says that he actually did it. And even though if he did do it, I think it might have been a little bit gross. But there are countless saints that have gone before us to give us guidance about what it means to have our own interaction with the risen, invisible Christ. Elie Wiesel is actually one of the people who shows us the way, not from a uniquely Christian perspective. He was a Jew, but there is something that he found out about how it is that faith comes alive. Remember, at the beginning of the story, he had declared his faith dead. He'd said that evil had consumed his faith, that he had lost his desire to live. But that's not the end of his story. He rediscovered the desire to live, even though it took him a long time. And more importantly than that, he rediscovered the presence of God. He wrote a book called Souls on Fire. It reflects the fact that he found a community of Jewish people who experienced great pain, but whose souls were on fire. And Eugene Peterson, the Christian pastor, had a chance to listen to Elie Wiesel, and he testifies that Wiesel's heart, his soul, was, in fact, on fire. Souls on Fire records Elie Wiesel's insights about what he learned from Hasidic Judaism. That's the most mystical stream of Judaism. And I think there are things that we as Christians can learn and that are, in fact, in the text that we read today. Here are a couple of insights that I hope you will interact with and drink into your souls. Wiesel learned something about the inevitability of contradictions in this life. In Souls on Fire, he said, "Do not fear contradictions. Contradictions are an intrinsic part of man." And here I think he's saying, they are an intrinsic part of the human experience. I wonder what contradictions you are facing these days that perhaps have diminished your faith. Contradictions are part of the human experience. I have a friend whose 10-year-old kid has multiple disabilities. She's precious, but she's vulnerable. And she recently had to undergo a heart surgery at age 10. And when she woke up, they wouldn't allow her to drink fluids for a period of time until the anesthetic wore off. I think the fear was that the anesthetic would make the water would make her nauseous, and then it would be damaging to the healing process of her heart. But when she woke up, she was sitting with her dad, and she just kept saying to him, "I'm thirsty. I'm thirsty. Give me some water, Daddy." And for hours, he just had to say, "No, I can't give you water now. You're on IV fluids. You're not going to die of thirst. You're going to be okay." I think life is like that. Why in the world, in her experience, would her father not give her water? She's so thirsty. But for her own good, he could not give it to her. Life is like that. There are contradictions. There are things that we don't understand. We are like children in the grand scheme of things. In our story today, Thomas comes in contact with the ultimate contradiction, that in the world, the wounds of Christ are the signs of defeat and humiliation. They're the signs of the end of a dream. But in the resurrection, Christ's wounds are the signs of God's love. They're the reassurance of God's power. It's a contradiction, but Thomas comes to embrace this contradiction, and in it he finds life. The life of faith is filled with contradictions, isn't it, friends? More so than we want. Bad things happen to good people. But if we continue in trust, God will use even the tragedies to shape our character, to make us strong and resilient, to be a blessing of hope to many. We've all had the experience of painfully disappointment, the experience of unanswered prayer. And yet, none of us would be here apart from answered prayers, most of which we will never know about. People have not told us what they were praying for us, but God has answered their prayers, and yet we are here. How do we put those puzzle pieces together? It feels like a contradiction. Before I move on to Wiesel's second point, I simply want to urge you to embrace that contradictions are inherent to the life of faith in the risen Christ. A God without contradictions is a God we can control, which is to say, a God without contradictions is a God who is smaller than we are. And a life without contradictions is a life without wonder. We are invited to embrace the contradictions, especially the contradiction of Jesus' wounds at the cross. The other point I wanted to make is that Wiesel learned something about the mystical power of authentic human presence. He said, everything becomes possible by the mere presence of someone who knows how to listen, how to love, and how to give of him or herself. He's speaking of Hasidic saints, rabbis, saintly people who know how to listen, know how to love, know how to give of themselves, because they know that all of life is sacred, that God is present in the midst of our ordinary, mundane lives. The power of a listening, loving, and sacrificial presence leads to great possibility. Mystical realities descend upon us. My friend couldn't give his daughter the water that she thirsted for, but he gave her what she needed to endure. And maybe we could say, even in the discomfort, he gave her what she needed to endure for the rest of her life, an awareness of a loving presence who would sit by her side and continue to look out for what's best for her. In our story, Thomas finds that there is no presence more attentive, more loving, or more sacrificial than the presence of the risen Christ. And the presence of Christ ushers us into unimaginable possibilities. We want answers, but the human soul ultimately thirsts for a deep sense of connection, of presence. And so I want to invite us into that. You know, when we struggle with doubt, sometimes we want to go away in a room and think things through ourselves. And you can go away in a room or go on a retreat and think things through for yourselves, but ultimately there needs to be a place of connection. We've talked about our Alpha program. If you're at the beginning of your spiritual journey, Alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet. And I want to assure you that there are some things that are hard to figure out in the world of faith apart from a meaningful connection with others. And at Alpha, if you sign up, you will find a meaningful connection with loving, bright, engaging, non-judgmental people. And if you are at a different place in your spiritual journey, there are ways to seek connection with authentic presence by asking and offering prayer. Asking for and offering prayer. In Silicon Valley, too few of us ever ask for or offer to pray for others. And that perhaps is the most deep and meaningful sense of connection. Finally, Let me say a few words in closing. Thomas is our hero of faith here. He embraces contradiction and interacts with the real presence of Christ. And when he does, something miraculous happens. He exclaims to Jesus, "My Lord and my God." Those are mystical words that Thomas says. It's the first time these words have ever been uttered in human history to a human being, "My Lord and my God." In his transformation, Thomas, who was last, becomes first. Thomas, whose faith was least, makes the greatest declaration. In the presence of the risen Christ, Thomas's doubt is transformed into deeply rooted conviction, and a whole stream of the church in India attributes their existence to Thomas. They tell us that he ultimately died for his faith there. And in the same way, as you lean into the presence of the risen Christ, he will make you fearless as well. He will make us a blessing to many. He will heal your faith. As we worship today, I want to invite you to reflect on a couple of questions. How is the gauge of your faith reading today? Is it empty or is it full or somewhere in between? And what is it that has contributed to the emptying or fullness of your faith? Let that come into your awareness. And is there one of Wiesel's insights that the risen Christ is inviting you to embrace today? Is he inviting you to surrender to some contradiction or to connect with the power and presence of others that connects us to the presence of God? If you want, you can pause the stream, journal about these questions or converse about them, and then come back and worship. Lord, bless my friends who are listening to this message. May your word to them bring expansive faith and new hope. I pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.